With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Book Spectrum. I'm your host, Chris Cordania. This is where we bring you longtime writers and new authors from varied professions across the spectrum. We know quite a bit about the great decisions of world history, the well-designed Operation Overlord, looking for an alternative trade route to Asia, declaring independence from the British Empire, and that could be a number of countries there, etc., etc. But there were some pretty bad ideas out there. We remember military blunders from the likes of Custer, Napoleon, Hitler, among others. With me now is voice man and producer Mike Smith, whose new audiobook looks deeply into the world's, I'll just call them historical lowlights. It's titled 100 of the Worst Ideas in History. Again, it's an audiobook. Welcome to Book Spectrum, Mike Smith.
Hey, great to be here, Chris. You've got a great show.
I'm glad you're here, and you're like me, you're a production guy, but you've always been a history buff.
Yes.
What inspired you to get into history?
I always did well in history in school. In fact, if I can brag for a second, Chris, I was in a school of 300 graduates. I was number four. Overall, and I was number one in history. It just always drew me. I always thought that the events of the past had such relevance and such resonance to the present that I think it's a mistake to ignore it and not know it because, as the old saying goes, you're bound to repeat it if you don't know it.
It would be nice if people paid attention to all of that and our history. Heck, not just American history, world history, and maybe gave it some respect.
Yeah, it's really, Chris, it's not even taught in school these days to any great extent. And I think that's disappointing. I think it's a very important element of any personal development. And to ignore that in curricula these days, I think, again, is a sets back the knowledge base of the graduates who are coming out of school right about this time.
It's sort of a disservice to them, and we can really get into that a little bit later on. I want to get to the book just a bit first, though. You could have written,
sure.
Mike, you could have written 100 of the best ideas in history, but why the focus on the worst?
Well, you know, my co-author Eric and I are both writers. I run my own video advertising agency, as you alluded to. And Eric is a former speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush. He's written for the LA Times, New York Times, CBS News, Washington Post. So we kick around ideas all day long, and we have a great appreciation for what it takes to come up with a good idea. And a lot of empathy when that seemingly good idea goes terribly wrong. So we have just been collecting these ideas over the years in our kind of personal Rolodex. We took about 3 years of research, and the result is what you see in the book today. We're drawn to bad ideas because we feel such empathy, having come up with so many bad ideas ourselves, that I think there's a lot that can be learned from it. So that's why we sort of focused on that. And it's fun to sort of, you know, to be honest, laugh at the misfortune of others, as long as it doesn't have any great impact on that individual or on the rest of society at large.
Oh, there you go. The good thing, though, is you didn't write 100 mediocre ideas throughout history. That would probably be pretty boring.
Yeah, I don't think that would have flown off the bookshelves at Barnes & Noble. I think people are drawn to a little bit of, what's it called, schadenfreude?
There we go.
A little bit of glee in the misfortune of others. You know, I think we're all into that to some extent, and I have to confess I am as well.
Let's get into it this way. You and your co-author, Eric Kassum, had to bounce these ideas off each other. What was your process? How did you kind of brainstorm some of these things?
Well, interestingly, it sort of started at a party at my house, and we were, you know, kind of gathered around the kitchen island, and yes, the adult beverages were flowing, and what happened is I would say, hey, have you heard the one about, so a little bit of the Cliff Clavin kind of syndrome from the TV show Cheers, where there's always a guy at the end of the bar who's got a story, right, and everybody at the bar listens, and then they want to top it, so he and I went back and forth, have you heard the one about this, have you heard the one about that? And before long, a crowd sort of gathered around us, and were chuckling and throwing in their own ideas. And, you know, before long, I turned to Eric and said, hey, either this is an idea for a book or a college-level drinking game. I don't know what it is, but I think there's something here. So he and I set out, and when we started, we had maybe 20 ideas in our head from the past, and we said, no, that's just not enough for a book. So we really buckled down. We went on the internet. We actually traveled to libraries. Remember that? You used to go to a library. And we looked up a whole bunch of stuff. And after about 3 years, we came back with what we thought was a pretty solid 100 ideas. You know, there are also six side stories as well. So you've got probably about 120 different ideas in this book that seemed to be good at the time and then went terribly wrong.
Yeah, like there are a lot of examples throughout history. One of them that always glares in my head is, who was that? It was Margaret Pohl, whose execution was carried out by a rookie or perhaps a very green executioner. That was kind of messy. But
Yeah, that was a messy one and didn't go well. And what you'll find with these stories is that the initial concept seems to be solid, or at least in the moment seems to be solid.
Right.
And then as it falls down in the execution, and then later on you look back on it and say, what the heck were they thinking? It couldn't possibly, if everything had gone right, what would have been the outcome? And you can't really think of what that might have been because it was so bad from the get-go.
It seemed like a good idea. You sit there, you say, like the Yankees did when they brought up Robinson Cano and Melky Cabrera. Let's try these new guys. Maybe they can do a good job and inject some good vibes to the rest of the team. That kind of worked out. But saying, well, let's say maybe we get a young up-and-coming executioner. Yeah, let's do that. And that, like you said, the execution literally wasn't that good.
No, it literally, the word execution comes into play there pretty soundly. And, you know, speaking of the Yankees, we've got a story in here about Babe Ruth I might want to share with you. And if you'd like to hear it, it's called The Bambino's Curse on the Beantown Bombers. And the bad idea here was to sell pitcher Babe Ruth to the New York Yankees. If you'd like, I'll get into it. It's kind of a fun story.
And keep in mind, and I just want to, for the listeners out there, it's really simple to look back at this, and it was a bad decision. And maybe some of that's in hindsight. You look back, and in 1918, the Red Sox thought they were just getting rid of a fat drunk.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, but this guy could pitch and hit. He was really good.
He was a pitcher at the time, and the owner of the Boston Red Sox is named Harry Frazee. He's a Broadway producer. And after presiding over 5 Red Sox World Series titles in 15 years, Frazee thinks his team is strong enough to withstand the departure of Babe Ruth, also known as the Bambino. So he's scrounging for cash to finance his Broadway plays, and the Sox owner here decides to sell Ruth to the Yankees for $100,000 in cash and $300,000 in loans. Now, that's a fairly large amount of money back then, and I can see how he was tempted to do that. But he can later only gasp in disbelief as Ruth goes on to, single-handedly transform the game. He's baseball's lifetime home run leader, the most popular athlete of his day, a charter member of the Baseball Hall of Fame. In leading the formerly downtrodden Yankees to 7 championships in 15 years. And the Red Sox, on the other hand, endured 8 decades of flubs, blunders, near misses, each attributed to the curse of the Bambino, I should say,
that was a big
on
curse.
Their way to winning 0 World Series titles between Ruth's 1920 departure and 2004.
Lost in all this, and Mike Smith is with me, his book is The 100 of the Worst Ideas in History. It's an audio book, so if you're listening to Mike's very cool, jaunty voice, it's much more, and it's even more fun if you listen to the book. Lost in all this, how did that play turn out?
Well, he sprinkled that money over a number of Broadway flops, unfortunately,
boy,
for Mr. Frazee. None of them memorable. None of them went anywhere. They were mostly off-Broadway, didn't even make it to Broadway. And Frazee went to his deathbed saying, I guess I shouldn't have done that. I guess I shouldn't have sold Mr. Ruth at a time when, heck, his team was doing very well and could have continued to do well. Who would have thought, though, that 80 plus years, they would have gone without a World Series title?
And the valuable lesson should be learned a little over 100 years later, which is today. The California Angels, well, I guess they're the Los Angeles Angels now. I don't even know where they are. Anaheim, whatever they are now, the Angels. They have Shohei Ohtani, a big two-way threat. He's a masher, and he is a star pitcher. Do not try to sell him to another team to finance terrible television programs or a terrible play or maybe a bad Hollywood movie. Just don't do it. Learn the lessons of the past.
I agree. That's my team. I'm 8 miles away from Anaheim Stadium where I'm sitting right now. And I've met Shohei. He doesn't speak a lot of English, but he's a great guy. He's an impressive person. He's the ultimate two-way player with quite a toolbox of skills. And you put him with Mike Trout, and he should have a good team. But my Angels, my gosh, they just don't seem to go anywhere. I used to work on that, with my production company. We did the Angels advertising for 3 or 4 years, and I am taking full credit for them winning the World Series in 2001.
Well, that's
even
cool.
Though I had absolutely nothing to do with it.
But they had a really good team back then, and I thought it was dedicated to Gene Autry, though, right? They dedicated that to Autry because he was the well-beloved owner of the team for the long time.
That's right.
But this.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino. Asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This incident, it was thought to have been a pretty good idea. The Red Sox getting rid of a fat drunk and maybe facilitating some plays, opening up a position for another couple of players. It just seemed okay. It seemed like a neat idea at the time. Some of history's bad ideas were actually well thought out, and that's what it brings me to, and could have been good ones. You have a lot of those in the book, so throw one at us.
Well, I'll tell you, here's one that seemed to be the right idea. It's called E.T.'s Mission to Mars Aborted. And this is 1981. And this bad idea comes from the chocolate-covered nuts, as we call them, at Mars Incorporated, the candy people. And they turned down perhaps the greatest product placement opportunity in movie history. So, Chris, you've seen the movie. We've all seen the movie E.T. In the film, young Elliot lures E.T., the extraterrestrial, out of hiding with a trail of candies. So E.T.'s producers approach Mars Incorporated for permission to use one of their products in the film. They figure a visitor from another planet would most likely be attracted to the most popular candy on Earth, which is M&Ms. So the space cadets, though, at Mars say no. They further state, we don't want an alien eating our candy. It's going to frighten the children. You can imagine. So now E.T.'s producers are stuck, and they scramble to find a replacement. They stumbled upon an obscure, largely unpopular candy Hershey has been struggling with called Reese's Pieces. And a deal is struck where Hershey agrees to pay absolutely nothing for placing Reese's Pieces in the film. Zero. In exchange, they promote the movie and some of their own advertising for the candy. Well, we all know that E.T. then rockets past Star Wars to become the highest-grossing film of that time. And at the same time, sales of Reese's Pieces blast off with it. So Hershey's calls it the biggest marketing coup in history, and product placement becomes a staple in TV and movies thereafter. So it seemed that they were being very safe and protective of their brand. But my gosh, what a tremendously bad idea to just pass on that. And we all know Reese's Pieces from that movie. No one knew what they were before, and now everybody knows what they are.
With me is Mike Smith, the author of the audiobook, 100 of the Worst Ideas in History. It's a fun book, a lot of great stories. How did you narrow it down to only 100, though? Because there were a lot of really, really bad ideas. World War I, as an overall strategy by the Allies for a long time, was just a bad idea all around.
It started, Chris, in a very interesting way. I can certainly get into that story as well. We call it a confused chauffeur starts a world war. And with the 100th anniversary at the start of World War I just a few years back, it was timely then. I think it's timely now. And the year is 1914. And this involves a tinderbox area of the world, Serbia, Croatia, Bosnia, you know, the former Yugoslavia. It's an area the United States has been involved in over time, and especially in the 1990s under Clinton. So at this point in 1914, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, not the rock group, the actual person, is heir to the throne of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which now controls this region of Bosnia. And he's parading through the streets of Sarajevo with his wife in an open-air limousine. So at the parade is a group of Serbians known as the Black Hand. And whenever you hear the name Black Hand, you know what comes next is not great. And they don't like Franz Ferdinand. They don't like anything about the Austro-Hungarian Empire, who's now kind of lording over their region. So they get together, and they go into a garage, and they make a bunch of bombs. And yes, back in those days, you had bomb throwers. These are people who made bombs and threw them at you. Now, that's a term euphemistically today that connotes anybody who takes a verbal pot shot at another person, a bomb thrower. But back in those days, they actually made bombs and threw them at you. So the Black Hand militants take a bomb, and they toss it at Franz Ferdinand as his motorcade passes. It misses him, but it hits some of the spectators who are standing along the parade route and injures about 20 to 50 people. And out of the goodness of his heart, Franz decides later that day to visit these victims of the bomb blast in the hospital and maybe offer his support and consolation. So he instructs, and here comes the bad idea, he instructs his limo driver to head to the local hospital. Again, bad idea. The driver has no idea where he's going. He takes a wrong turn and comes to a stop on what is essentially a dead-end street. And it's right in front of a sandwich shop. Inside the sandwich shop is one of the would-be assassins from earlier that day. He's chewing on a sandwich and looks out the window, and to his utter astonishment, he sees Franz Ferdinand sitting at a dead stop right there in front of him. The guy he was trying to throw a bomb at earlier that day is right there. So kind of like Dirty Harry in the movie where he's got a hot dog in one hand and a magnum in the other, he's got a sandwich in one hand and a gun in the other. He walks up to the car and sadly shoots both Franz Ferdinand and his wife in the back of the head, killing them both. And this is the assassination that lights the powder keg that starts World War I. 24 million casualties. So one wrong turn responsible indirectly for 24 million deaths.
That's a big blunder right there. And even you progress throughout World War I, the strategies, the way the war was fought, the trenches and everything else, it was almost like one huge blunder after another.
And, you know, it's also World War I, and this is in the book as well, is also somewhat responsible, speaking of pandemics, which seems to be just a little bit in the news these days. The Spanish flu pandemic of 1918 through 1922 was in large part due to the trench warfare, where soldiers were shoulder to shoulder in the war. One of them catches the flu, and they all catch the flu. And not only that, they all then, when their tour of duty is over, go back home and spread it to everybody in their town. So that was the last really big pandemic, and World War I had a lot to do with it.
Exactly. And there was that extra spike, too. So all over Europe, all over whoever was fighting, it was a huge mess. And the funny thing is, it was called the Spanish flu, yet Spain almost had almost nothing to do with that.
Yeah, it's interesting how these names come around. And of course, there's been a lot of backlash against calling anything with the current pandemic Wuhan flu or Chinese flu or anything like that. That one may or may not have any more credibility to it, but you're right to say that the Spanish flu had almost nothing to do with Spain, and they got hung with that rap.
Exactly.
Regardless, it didn't really start there. It started throughout Europe, throughout the war front, and came back and visited itself among all of the countries who fought in that war.
Mike, for the book, and you did have to pare it down to 100, the top 100 worst ideas in world history. I'm a radio guy. I've been there for a long time. And one of the books I've loved was called Bubbling Under. It was about songs that didn't quite make the Billboard top 100. Those that were maybe 101, maybe 110. Songs that were of note, but didn't quite become a chart success or even a minor chart success. Having said that, what were some of the maybe bubbling under blunders, one or two of those that didn't quite make the cut?
That's interesting. We were actually on the fence about quite a few of them. Speaking of DJs, I wonder, this one almost didn't make the cut, but I'd like to tell you about it anyway. And it did end up making a cut because it's about a DJ. And if you like, I'll get into it. It's under our topic of major league stupidity.
Let's do it.
This is Disco Inferno Singes the Socks.
Oh, that was
S-O-X.
That was great. Yes, yes.
You remember this one. It's July of 1979, and we're at the, Chris, we're at the high point of the platform shoe and polyester leisure suit era known as disco. And by the way, as popular as disco was, in fact, I was a club DJ during that era, so you know I'm no spring chicken. Lots of people hated disco music and that whole look at me disco attitude, especially diehard sports fans. So enter Wild Child Chicago disc jockey Steve Dahl. And he comes up with something called Disco Demolition Night. You got to hear this. And here's how it works. For just 98 cents plus a vinyl disco record, you get into a Chicago White Sox baseball doubleheader. Sounds good so far. And between games, Dahl collects up the records, piles them up in the outfield, then uses explosives to blow them to smithereens. Here's the problem. Upon detonation, a crater forms in the outfield. Vinyl shards fly through the air like shrapnel, a fire erupts. Fueled by booze and weed, the disco-despising stadium crowd then spills onto the field. Others in the parking lot storm the gates, and they're on the field as well. Soon a full-scale riot is raging, with fans wrecking a batting cage, gouging infield turf, burning banners. Scores of people are injured. Hundreds are arrested. And Detroit Tiger manager Sparky Anderson takes one look at the mayhem and refuses to allow his team onto the field for game two of the doubleheader. And the White Sox are forced to forfeit the second game, marking the last time in history an American League team has dealt an automatic loss.
Now, one of the men behind that, actually the man who was behind that on the White Sox end, was Mike Vec. As you know, Mike Vec is the son of the great Bill Vec, and both of them were famous for coming up with interesting gimmicks, interesting things to do when it came to, let's just say, making a baseball game or the experience at the stadium a bit more interesting. Those were real promo guys, and you think that might have been a good idea, except for the fact that you destroyed your field.
And you lost the game, automatically. I think Bill Vec was the guy who also, maybe I'm wrong about this, I believe he brought, and I guess you can't say the term midget, a little person in full uniform to the plate in an actual White Sox game to bat.
Eddie Goodell.
The strike zone, there it is, you know, and because the strike zone was so small or short or narrow, whatever you want to call it, I believe the guy got a walk because they couldn't find the strike zone. The guy was crouching way down. He was only, you know, maybe 4 feet tall to begin with. And I believe he had elephants on the field. He had all kinds of crazy trapeze artists. And he did everything he could to get the White Sox this notoriety back in those days.
Also, was it Eddie Goodell he was told not to swing in no uncertain terms. And he wore number 1/8, by the way. He's the only guy to ever wear number 1/8 or wear a fraction as his number. That's it.
Oh, that's funny. Yep. I didn't know that. That's a nice adjunct to, you know, to that story. You know, you talk about other bad ideas. You know, I've got, we can get into any number of them. But I really like both Milli Vanilli and New Coke. I don't know if you want to get into either one of those two, but they're pretty funny, bad ideas from the music world and one from the corporate world. If you're open to it, I'll hop into one of them.
Sure, let's do that. And I want to interject. In hindsight, the idea of putting two pretty guys up front and having somebody else sing for them is not exactly new. I know there was CNC Music Factory that kind of did that, but they only did that for their videos. Not exactly. They didn't create an act. They kind of create a conglomerate, or let's say an arts group, whereas there will be singers and performers, but there will be beautiful models actually performing in the videos. Milli Vanilli was touring. They were just two guys, and they were really poor. And if I was in their position, I would have done it.
Yeah, exactly. And we called this story How to Lip Sync, S-I-N-K, a Music Career. And it's the bad idea here is to create a pop music group led by two singers who cannot sing. It would seem to be a problem. The genius behind it is Frank Farian, who is this uber-successful German music producer. And we're talking about the late 1980s. And he's scouring the 80s Berlin club scene, looking for the next big thing in music. And he happens upon two male models named Fabrice Morvan and Rob Pilatus. And they're out there tearing up the dance floor and two, I guess, the most or no more than hunky, prancing boy toys. But to Farian, this producer dude, they're the ideal frontmen for a new band. And soon the pop group Milli Vanilli is born. And there's one problem, as I noted. Neither Rob nor Fab can sing. So to cover that rather glaring deficiency, Farian secretly hires professional vocalists to record all Milli Vanilli songs. And he directs Rob and Fab to lip sync to these recordings whenever performing live. So Milli Vanilli takes off like a we say, hip-hopping missile. And then just as quickly, the missile explodes. At a 1989 MTV Live concert, Rob and Fab are lip-syncing and gyrating to their big hit, Girl, You Know It's True, when the record skips, the recording skips, and you hear, Girl, You Know It, Girl, You Know It, Girl, You Know It. It's the same lines as he's repeating and forcing them to just lip-sync that same line of the song over and over. So be right there on live TV. The Milli Vanilli fraud is exposed, and outraged fans demand that the musical imposters be, as we say, strung up by their dreadlocks. Dozens of lawsuits follow. Arista Records breaks their recording contract. The Best New Artist Grammy Award is returned in shame, and their short-lived careers in disarray. Fab slips into obscurity, and Rob unfortunately dies of a drug overdose in 1998. And really, Chris, in the wake of that, it refocused attention, I think, even today on lip syncing, and critics have gone after Britney and Bieber and Beyonce, all the bees, for, you know, fake singing live performances. It's a live performance, it seems to be, you know, not a great idea. Fans go there and they pay their money to see them perform live. And if it's not live, gosh, you know, that's kind of a letdown. I think it's kind of accepted on television appearances back when I was a kid on any given TV show, American Bandstand or any talk show where you knew a band was going to appear. They were pretty much always lip syncing. But that fell out of favor, and Milli Vanilli just helped to push it over the edge.
Well, the big thing was they got the Best New Artist. The fans were deceived. Again, in something like The Archies, that was a fake band all around, or CNC Music Factory, that was a conglomerate. That was just a bunch of techs and some singers. And it was known that models were the ones performing the videos, that sort of thing. So that, you were told that these guys were actually singing. Lip syncing, again, if you think about that, that's what got Ashley Simpson in trouble when she was lip syncing at Saturday Night Live. But it was acceptable before Milli Vanilli.
It was to a large extent. And I think it fell out of favor because of the cost of live event tickets, live concert tickets is so high these days that when you go there, you're expecting to see a live show, not the record that you already own and that you can listen to in your car or when you're jogging. You know, you want to hear them give it a shot and then evaluate if it's as good as, better than, different, in what way interesting, as opposed to the record.
The only thing you don't want to do is you don't want to hear those auto-tune people try to sing live. They're terrible.
Oh, God.
They have to lip sync. But I think it's a dead giveaway that they're manufactured because of the auto-tune. Tired of auto-tune.
Well, again. And we can certainly debate that kind of a concept to take as somebody who can't really sing well and then not lip sync, but rather process their voice in a way that makes them sound different from the inherent talent that they have. I don't know. Is that untruth in advertising? Is that a bait and switch? Maybe. But I guess at the end of the day, you know, the end product is what's important to most people. And if they like the way it sounds, maybe they don't care how the sausage got made.
Exactly. Mike Smith is the author of, I say definitely the co-author of the book, 100 of the Worst Ideas in History, but it's an audio book. You get to hear the cool voice of Mike Smith. That's going to be a lot of fun. A lot of cool effects in there, things like that. It's a really great listen. I want to note something we talked about before, and it's important to take away a bunch of things from this book. One of them is we should learn from history. I do note the way education, academics, and pop culture has degenerated quite a bit in the U.S. is in direct correlation with a complete disinterest and, in many cases, disregard for history. That's why we're seeing statues being pulled down. History being rewritten, if you will, even by major newspapers. I suppose ignorance is bliss, but that's not going to help when it comes to making decisions in the future, is it?
I think you're right. And one of the reasons that we did the book was to, on the altruistic side, we're donating at least a copy of the book for every book we sell to local schools here in Southern California, in an effort to at least do some small part to reinvigorate the knowledge of interest in history. And we think if we do it in the infotaining, shall we say, way that we're doing it with both the printed book and the audio book, that maybe it will stimulate some additional interest. And to bookend it back, pardon the pun, to where we were at the start of this conversation, it's important to know it. I think history comes in handy every day in my personal life and in my business when I'm dealing with people from other countries and people from other parts of this country. It's important to sort of know a little bit of the background of their culture and their mores and their language. And I think not knowing that puts you at a real disadvantage. So that's why we're making those donations to schools. We're also planning, Chris, real quick, to put together a traveling roadshow with these stories and with audiovisual accompaniment that would travel to groups and schools. And again, in the interest of pioneering some new interest in history.
It's argued that they don't get enough history as far as, or proper history being taught to them. And it's not easy, too. You're trying to cram a lot of things into a short period of time and maybe a little extra time. Maybe a nice, fun presentation of American and world history to young people will make them more interested and appreciate it. And that's a great thing you're doing.
Yeah, I think, not to get too esoteric about this, but I think when you teach history based on what we call dead guys and dates, it has very little resonance with a young mind. But when you present it from a personal perspective, from highlighting the personalities involved and the intellects involved and the attitudes and the efforts involved in these historical events and these initiatives, I think an individual, even a young person, can look at that and say, well, that person is just like me. I understand where they're coming from now. So, wow, that person's involvement or starting of a world event or a product that went awry or an entertainment effort or anything in the financial world, I kind of get where they're coming from and I can relate to it. So I'm going to listen, I'm going to absorb, I'm going to learn from it and maybe apply it to my life as I move forward.
Excellent. Thank you very much for being with us here, Mike Smith, on Book Spectrum.
Thank you.
Once again, the title of the book, it's an audio book. It's 100 of the Worst Ideas in History. Check it out. Where can you get it, Mike?
You can get it at Audible. You can get it at Amazon, iTunes, at 100worstideas.com, and the printed book at Barnes & Noble and better retailers everywhere.
And we will have links to those outlets on our website, bookspectrum.com. I'm Chris Cordani. I want to thank Mike Smith for being our guest, and I want to thank you for listening to Book Spectrum.